Okay, so it's October 19th, 2022. I need to light that screen so I can read it. 1501, I was going to say, there were 30 seconds, so I was going to say 1503 for some reason, but obviously it's, the three was not for the minutes. I just woke up, so I'm kind of, I want to make the video before I get busy doing something. So that's the reason I make them just when I get up. And it's Ward Green here. It is, like I probably said, Wednesday, October 19th, 2022. Pretty sure I said that. 1502 hours now. And I got my arrowroot powder just arrived. This is like 2 pounds. It's 2 pounds. Literally 2 pounds. So this is, where do you put it? So that the camera can see it. Yeah, that's good. What does it say in kilograms? Well, 908 grams, yeah. And arrowroot powder. Beautiful, organic. Very hefty package for something I've never used, which is arrowroot powder. I don't know what that's for, actually. We know, we used to, of course, I know. Many of us probably know the arrowroot cookies. Arrowroot cookies. Arrowroot is even hard to say, actually, because of the R's, I guess. That makes it difficult to pronounce. The other thing I wanted to talk about. This is a wrench that I made for my... Well, there's a couple things I wanted to talk about, actually, but this is another thing. The wrench, I made this out of a piece of aluminum, just happen to have a quarter inch piece, or I think it's a quarter inch, of aluminum, aircraft aluminum or something, you know, good, it's good quality aluminum that I bought years ago. I had a piece like, probably this was the length that I already, it was in this length when I decided to use it as a wrench. I just took the bandsaw, I made a couple of cuts, cut out this section. Somehow, it's not a very smooth cut. I possibly cut straight in, and then I cut. You know, you can come in with the bandsaw, right? And you can cut in a curve where you sort of you're coming in and you're cutting, starting here and coming around there like that to get the cut. And then you come the other way, and then you come there to get that cut. And then that's after you've cut these two with the bandsaw. Anyway, I just made this because I was installing my sink, and I didn't have a pipe wrench. I still don't have a pipe wrench. I don't own a pipe wrench. But I built this. I just made it. I fabricated this when I installed the sink so I could tighten up the nut on the sink. And underneath the sink, there's a nut that's just too big for a crescent, for any crescent wrench I have. So this was my wrench, and I just keep it as a wrench. And the thing is, I could use it for anything else, too, if I wanted to. What's the word for that? Well, sacrifice it or whatever, but I mean, to try and use it for it, I could... there's a word. I'm trying to think of the word. The idea is... taking it from one purpose and destroying it for that purpose and using it for a different purpose. I could... repurpose is one word. But there was another word I was trying to think of that has a more sacrificial type meaning. But this is... I could repurpose it. But I haven't repurposed it. It's a wrench. And what I did was, the thing is, the reason I wanted to talk about it is because when I did install the plasma cutter, I needed to tighten a nut that was just, it turned out it was exactly the same size as this, which is, you know, impossible, usually. But I guess it's a standard size, whatever it was. That's why it worked. But this happened to be useful for more than just the sink. It's useful for tightening the air regulator, the pressure regulator on the plasma cutter. because I had nothing else to tighten it with. Like, I had no idea how I would do that unless I went and bought another wrench. But this was available in my shop because I made this years ago, quite a few years ago when I installed that sink. When did I install the sink? I'm not even sure. If it was, I have a feeling maybe Anne was not with us at that time, because I don't remember her being involved at all in that. I don't think, so I think that means it was less than 6 years ago, but I can't believe that it was less than 6 years ago, can I? It's difficult for me to believe that. But if Anne had been here, I would not have had the time to install it either, not in her final days, so I was too busy with her, helping her for her final days, so I'm not sure. That's why I think it must have been after she passed, and then, but that means it's less than 6 years ago that I've installed it, and that seems wrong. It seems like that sink has been there for decades almost. Like it's a beautiful one-piece fire brick or porcelain or whatever you want to call it. It's not really porcelain because it's fire brick. I don't think it's the same as porcelain. But I forget the other thing that it's equivalent to, fire brick. I'll look it up. Let's go Bible. Just to get onto the, while we're looking at our today's scripture, let's start looking at our daily script, daily, our reading for today. While we're doing that, and I'll look up, what is fire brick? Is it one word? No. It's ceramic. Yeah. What's the difference between fire brick? Okay. Fire brick. Sink. Let's see. I think it's fire brick. Oh, it's fire clay. Yeah, it's fire clay, not fire brick. Right. The fire clay sink. That's what it is. Fire clay. Good. I'm glad I looked it up. Okay, are they like porcelain? Compared to porcelain? Let's see. Fire clay are more sturdy than porcelain. Yeah, so I have a fire clay sink. One piece, sink and counter, all one piece. It's all, I'm not sure if you call it a vanity. You might. You might even call it a vanity because it, but it's a small, it's not really a vanity. Well, underneath there are cupboards, but I did not install any new cupboards. It's just the same cupboard that was there before, which was still in really good condition. Let me just get this in my own window so I can see myself here. So this is something I used to install that sink, but I only needed it to tighten the plumbing. But it's so important that you have to have a wrench to do that. You can't, there's no other way to grab onto that. You need some way, or you could use a strap. I've got rubber straps that, strap wrench, and that is another way to do it. The bigger it gets, the longer the strap has to be, the bigger the strap wrench has to be, the bigger this size gets, that dimension. But I just think it's not, for some reason, I probably thought of the strap wrench. For some reason, I couldn't use it or didn't use it. Maybe you can use it. If you have a big enough strap wrench, you can do that. You need to get enough leverage. This is not very long, so there's not a lot of leverage that I could get. But, you know, I could still get significant amount of torque. Torque being the length times the force that you push in a perpendicular direction. So, well, anyway, that's how torque wrenches work. They let you know when you're applying the correct torque. And well, I don't know how, actually I don't know how they work, but they have the ability to adjust that. So when you reach the torque, they slip at the correct torque. So the other thing I wanted to talk about is my chainsaw. For my chainsaw, I was out yesterday and I used my small 192 chainsaw, which is a steel. Well, both my chainsaws are steels. The other one is it the 362 or 262? I think it's a 362. It's a nice saw. The way I could find out, but I don't want to reveal everything on my hard drive, so let me do it somewhere else here. Steel. Let's look up steel in my system here. Let's look up 39. Let's look up 362. Yeah, it's a 362. 362 CM. It's got electronic ignition too. So I've got the 362, and the one that's the one I wanted to talk about yet, because yesterday I used my 192. It's an arborist saw. It's very small, and I was cutting small wood, and it was sharp. The chain was sharp. So I think, and I got it sharp using the steel sharpener, the one that comes with the steel. It's made by steel. It doesn't come with their saw. It's made by steel, and it costs maybe $50 or something, and I bought two of these because I have two different size chains. One with the 362 and one with the 192. So, but the thing I learned yesterday is I can use that, I learned it before maybe, but I was testing it yesterday as well, that sharpener that steel makes, which has files built into it, and it has a raker file built into it, it works reasonably well to sharpen the saw. It seems like to me it was cutting almost without applying any force at all. Like it was, and I was cutting a very hard wood, ash, which is very hard. It was dead ash, which is, the ash is pretty hard. And the other day I was using my 362 and using a skip chain because I just haven't changed the chain from the skip chain back to the regular chain. I wasn't even sure if I had the regular chain, but I do. I've got three chains and two saws. And I've got three bars and two saws, at least. Well, I might have a spare bar too, but I mean, I have, for the 362, which is the bigger one, I've got a 16-inch and a 20-inch bar. So I've got two 20-inch chains. One of them's a skip chain, but I haven't changed the skip chain because it was sharp enough and I was using it without changing it. But I don't know why I didn't change it, because there's no reason. What was I using it to? I wasn't ripping with it, but it's a ripping chain. I was ripping with it, of course. That's why I had it on there. I mean, but that was years ago when I ripped the big ash tree. That's still on the chain, still on the saw from then. I've never taken the chain off, but it's dull now, so I'm going to take that chain off and sharpen it before I take it off. I think I'll sharpen it. But then I'll put on possibly the regular 20-inch chain. It might already be sharp, and I might put that on first, actually, before I sharpen the... If it's already sharp, I don't have to do any sharpening. I'll just put that chain on there maybe, but I'm not sure. It depends how much time I have the day I do the work that I'm going to do, but I'm not even sure, yeah. But at some point, I will do some work, and I will change the chain on that saw probably, because I don't do a lot of ripping with that saw. But what I wanted to say is that I wanted to explain the situation with the chains that I've got, just for reference, so that I know it also, just remind myself as well. And but it looks like I definitely have a perfectly good 20-inch chain that I've never used, because when I bought the 362, I was buying it to do ripping, I think, as well as, obviously, not just ripping, but I mean, at the time I bought it, I needed to do ripping, and the small saw was not going to really, it actually, I could have done everything with the small saw. Yeah, I think I could have. But it was a thick enough tree, too, that I could almost not get to down to the bottom with the length of the blade that I had. The 192 has, the smaller saw has only a 16-inch blade, which is the maximum that it's rated to run. So they don't, steel doesn't make blades longer than that for that saw, and they don't make one longer than 20, I don't think, for their 362 either. So they don't recommend running anything longer than 20 inches. 20 inches is plenty long enough, too. It seems to me I can stand up, and even the 16-inch blade, I'm standing up, bucking. Small wood on the ground, I can easily reach the ground standing up with the 192 using the 16-inch chain. I don't see any problem bucking with that. Mind you, I'm using the blade vertical, you know, like I'm cutting it, at an angle. I'm holding the blade like this, and I'm cutting through, like maybe like that or something. You know, I'm cutting downward, but I can also just sort of push it down through the log. I mean, it's as long as I'm not going into the ground. And I can arrange the wood so I don't go into the ground if there's any danger of that. But when the saw is sharp, it's very easy to control it. And that's one of the points that I noticed that I wanted to mention, is that the steel sharpener does work. It does work if you give it enough passes, I guess. Maybe you have to give it enough passes to get it to work. But I have I can't understand why it wouldn't work, because they sell it, and they would do, if it didn't work, they wouldn't continue to sell it. And, you know, surely it wouldn't sell. People wouldn't buy it if it didn't work. It does actually work. So if it doesn't work for a certain person, maybe it's because they're not using it correctly. That's very easily the explanation there, because a lot of people, you know, a lot of people don't know how to use any particular tool that you can mention. There's lots of people who don't know how to use that particular tool. And this is a tool that was specifically designed by steel. So nobody knows how to use it if they haven't been taught properly, at least potentially. You know, it's a potential problem of maybe that the people using it don't know what they're doing with it. But I think I can do that. I'll be able to still do that for a while, because my saw was sharp. Like, it was sharp. Like when you're watching our friendly neighborhood woodsman and the saw, the weight of the saw is doing the cutting for you. That's the kind of thing I was seeing. It was, you know, very little pressure. And it's not, I've been using it, you know, on several occasions already, so it shouldn't be sharp. It shouldn't be that sharp, but it was still sharp enough to easily cut the wood. So, but I will, it now it's the time to sharpen it again, actually. But it should be just tweaked again, just brought back to its best possible condition before I use it again, I think. But I don't use my blades to where they get chewed up. Generally, I just keep them near the. Or generally, they don't get chewed up. The blades don't get damaged. They just get dull, and then I have to sharpen them. If your edge gets, you know, dinged or pitted or anything, you know, with any kind of damage, then you've got to take it. I mean, then you have to do some serious filing. But generally, I don't have that problem. Yesterday, I was using the oil, manual oiling with a toothbrush and heavy oil, and just it made me have. I had to stop frequently because I could only cut so many passes before I would have to oil it, and I knew when that was. people tell me you can listen to your chain. Maybe I could hear my chain. Somebody said that. I think I'll probably get so I can hear when the oil is run out. Although it's a noisy saw, so maybe I won't hear it. But anyway, I think there will be a way to know when to oil it, because the oil is gone when I'm doing manual oiling. And I'll probably, there is another way to oil it too, manually. I could just have a bucket full of oil, or a pan with oil in it, just run the saw through the oil. That's the obvious way to do it, but that takes a certain type of pan with a certain amount of oil that I didn't want to waste. Or I don't have a storage container for the used oil, I guess, but once I have that, that's the way to do it, I think. Just run the saw through the oil. Every so many cuts of wood, you just run the saw through the oil, or if you want it to be lubricated for a particular cut, run it through the oil. I don't see why that doesn't work. That should work fine. Maybe that's a bit messy. Probably is, or possibly that'll throw the oil onto me as the operator. I don't know. But I haven't tried that. But I think that seems to me, though, the way to prevent it throwing it onto you is to have a guard, have a thing that prevents the oil from coming back at you. Just have some kind of a barrier, like a wall, made of anything, cardboard or anything, would block it, block the oil. Yeah, there's a way to oil a chain, you know, without using a toothbrush. I'm just, for now, that's the way I was doing it. And I was able to get a couple of wheelbarrows full of wood cut, so that was pretty good, I stopped about four times maybe to oil it. That wasn't bad. And I'm intending to find out what's causing the oiler not to work, whether it's because there's the thing that drives it is broken or whatever it is. But I actually like the manual oiling. It's interesting how that goes. I mean, if the automatic oiler works, I mean, I'm not going to complain probably. I would just use it. But if it doesn't work, I'm actually glad it doesn't work, because that's one less thing that can break. It's already not working. Why? I don't have to maintain it. It makes life simpler. That's the idea, I think, behind it. All I got to do is keep the saw sharp and keep it running. And that's enough of a challenge sometimes, too. Keep the saw running is a challenge, because it gets clogged up in the carburetor or wherever the clogging occurs, and I need to use the seafoam to unclog it. So I squirt the seafoam in there, it starts up, and then but you know, if I haven't run it for a while, it gets kind of boggy, where I can't give it throttle without it stalling completely. But once it's really warmed up and it's been run for a while, I can keep it running at a fairly high rev, and it'll cut. And yesterday there was no real issue with that. It was perfect. There was no bogging yesterday. So that's because I used it the other few days ago, you know, and a week ago, whenever it was, when I did that other tree that I cut. I cut the dead tree a while ago, but yesterday I trimmed it. It was dry. I dragged it the other day. I dragged it over near the house here, and then I just chopped it up yesterday. So I'm thinking about the chin-up bar ideas. And I'm thinking, you know, the longer I think about that, I'll probably, now I'm talking about how to design something. When I'm doing design, I always find that the first idea is not going to be the best or the final idea, or it's never the final way to do it, because there's almost never, because for one thing, there's the designing of how to build it, the figure, the computations, the mental workings, the things that go through your head when you're trying to decide how you're going to build it, how you're going to do the cutting, right? How you're going to cut the wood. Or in this case, we're not building out of wood, we're building out of steel, angle iron and steel bar. So I don't have to cut the bar, hopefully. I'll just cut the angle iron. So how to cut it? See, I've simplified it by buying a bar that happens to be the length I want, and I don't have to cut the bar. And I have a piece of steel tube also, which is rectangular or square tubing. That could be used. I can't make a square with my fingers very easily. Maybe I can. It's square tubing. 1 1/4 inch square tubing. I could use that to build this chin-up bar if I didn't want to use the angle iron. Oh. And every design is not only a challenge, it's also an opportunity. So if I use the tubing, I'd have to figure out how do I cut tubing with a plasma cutter, because when I cut through the outside, the plasma is going to go inside. It's going to penetrate and start to hit the other side and start to cut that side at the same time, maybe. Or maybe it'll just mess it up or make a molten mess. I don't know what's going to happen if I try to cut tubing. So if I were to build it out of tubing, that would be an advantage in the sense it would be an opportunity to find out more about how to cut tubing with a plasma cutter. So every design is not only a challenge, it's also an opportunity. And you have to figure out how much do I want this to be a challenge and an opportunity of something doing something different, and how much do I want it to be a precise kind of operation where I don't get into any trouble and don't have any challenges, or, you know, how much of it should be challenging and how much do I want it to be, you know, pedestrian, easy. So if we want an easy job, we don't look for things that we don't fully understand. We want to understand what we're doing if we want it to be an easy job. And I think I understand how to cut the angle iron, because it's just an angle. So you just, you know, you can just take the plasma cutter, and I can just cut from one edge. You have to cut from the edge, but I wouldn't want to start at this edge, because the plasma would be cutting down through the full length here, which is, that wouldn't be right. That's like 2 inch. I don't think my plasma cutter can cut 2 inches anyway, but you wouldn't cut that way. So you cut from here. I cut through the 3/16 of an inch here. Then when I get to there, I stop. Before I get to this piece, I stop. And then I flip it this way, right? And then I have to cut from the other extremity in to there. And then I have to somehow cut this final bit, which is should be easy at that point. But the opportunity that I have here too is to figure out how precise of a cut can I make, like to find out what can I learn about precision of cuts with the plasma cutter. What I learned yesterday, or whatever day it was, it was very early in the morning yesterday, I think, but what I learned yesterday was cutting, I can make a fairly narrow kerf cut with the plasma cutter, something like about 1/16 of an inch. And it looks like I can cut pretty straight. But to cut straight, I'll have to use some kind of a... How will I cut straight? That's an issue, isn't it? I don't have any... It's not a pilot arc where I can have a metal guide on it. The guide can be running along a straight edge. But I can put it up against a straight edge. Yeah, I can put the nozzle up against a straight edge. So I could do it that way. Somehow I can make... So I have several different opportunities of learning how to cut with a straight edge, possibly. Or I could do it by hand, too. I have an opportunity. I have some decisions that I can make before I decide to start. And also, am I going to cut it up on the bench where the sparks will fly down below? Or maybe I can cut it on the floor so I don't have the problem with my shoes. I just have to kneel on the floor on some padding and, you know, and work on the floor, maybe. That might be how I should cut it. Because I want the angle iron to be supported on both ends when I cut it, too. I don't want one end to be sticking out. And then when I cut it, it starts to fall. It's heavy. I don't want it to fall on my feet. So there's a lot of... it's not a lot compared to a more difficult job. It's just that there are far more different things to consider than you might realize. Especially with something that's so heavy. This angle iron is so heavy, it could and fall, and you could even break my floor. Like it's could break the concrete. It's so heavy. So I mean, yeah, there are far more things to consider than one first thinks about when one considers cutting a piece of angle iron. Once you know, I mean, for me, I'm thinking. The first thought is, oh, it's so easy, you just cut it, you know. And it almost is that easy, but there are a lot of things you could actually get into, not just to make it more complicated, but to make it more, to learn more while you're doing it, to learn more about how much accuracy you can get. So every job is an opportunity to learn something very, very significant for a potential future job that might require more knowledge of some kind. So each job could be viewed in that way as a very important opportunity to learn something. It's a preliminary job for some future job that might be more complex. And so that's why there's so much benefit in planning how to do a certain job, is because of the job, not just because of this job, but because of the next job. But I mean, I'm not saying overthink it. I'm not going to try to overthink it. I'm just mulling it over in my mind. I'm just thinking, I'm letting my mind process it. But there's certainly not random thoughts, because random thoughts don't help at all. Although if I evaluate random thoughts, that would help, right? But I have to evaluate them. But my mind doesn't generate random thoughts. That's the thing. It can't. It can't generate random thoughts. It can only generate thoughts that it has seen before. That's another important idea, that random thoughts are things that happen. And they're never random. They always come from somewhere. Someone else causes them. There's no such thing really as random. There isn't such a thing. It doesn't exist. That's something to know, to be aware of. But we want to simulate random sometimes because it helps us to if we can, but I can't do it. But I mean, we do it by using the internet, because the internet's so many different thoughts, it's almost like random. So the internet can simulate randomness by doing research on the internet. We can get all kinds of answers that might seem they're more or less random, a lot of them. I mean, if we do random searches of random topics, if we could find a way to generate random topics, which we can't, but there are random generators on the internet. If we use the internet and we just go to the home page of YouTube, you know, or something like that, we might find every day there's something a bit different, so it's sort of random. Anyway, designing is not random. It's something where I'm focusing, in my case anyway, I can only speak for myself, but I'm focusing my ideas on an objective, an object of my intent. I'm planning to build something. I know what I'm trying to build, roughly, right? It's a chin-up bar. It's got two vertical supports that hang down from the ceiling, and then there's a horizontal bar. That's my idea. Now, I might change that. And it doesn't need any cross-bracing, because it can be attached at the ceiling, and it can be, well, it could be, I could do short cross braces between the bar and the vertical supports, and that would hold its shape then, and then I don't have to worry about it racking, you know, by pivoting on this, on the, then I only need to put two bolts. I don't need four at the top, two on each. Two on each would prevent it from moving, because it wouldn't be able to move with two. With one, it could just be shifting like that, like a pendulum, but with two it can't. The two have to be either tight, or they have to be, the bolts have to fit tight in the holes, one or the other, so that in order for it not to be able to rack. So it either has to be very precisely drilled holes in the metal, so that there's no play in the hole, in the two holes of each piece. Like, just look at one piece. If I put big holes in the two big holes, and then I put the wooden holes and they're smaller, well, those won't move, but the bolts won't move in the wooden holes, but the metal bar that has the bigger holes in it will move. It'll have some play if there's two of these holes, if the bolts are smaller than the holes, this will wiggle. It'll wiggle. And unless I tighten the bolts tight enough, and then it won't. So you see the design comes into it in that aspect as well. But if I build a vertical piece with the bar going across and then a cross brace that I weld on, well, that would partly limit where I can put my hands, maybe too, on the bar, but it's 4 feet long, so that's not an issue. But I could cross brace it, possibly. I've got other pieces of steel I could use maybe for that somewhere. What have I got? I don't know. The other thing is I could use the angle iron. I could cut the angle iron. I don't need a full angle iron all the way down. Like at the top, I could cut, or at the top or the bottom, or in the middle even. I could cut a piece out of the angle iron. I only need a flat piece of steel hanging down. I don't need the angle coming all the way down. So I could cut a piece out of the angle iron and use that as cross bracing. Or I could maybe find another scrap piece around the shop and use that or whatever for the for cross bracing. That cross bracing prevents wiggling. So there's no wiggling anymore. It's just a right angle shape, a U shape. That then I bolt on with, it only needs two bolts at the top. Big enough bolts to support human weight too. They've got to be, I'm thinking probably you want something like, you know, half inch is a good idea, but you don't, I mean, that's, if it's 70,000 pounds per square inch and you know, pi d squared over 4, or what is pi r squared, yeah, which is that's the area of the circle. But R is D over 2, the diameter divided by 2. So D over 2 squared is D squared over 4. So if the diameter of the bolt is half an inch, you square that, half inch squared is a quarter square inches, and then you go divide by 4 is a 16th times pi. 3 over 16 is... what is that? 2.2 roughly. So it's about 0.2, yeah. So 0.2 square inches is what you're talking about with a half inch bolt, if I did that math right. So 0.2 times 70,000 is what you're talking about. A fifth of 70,000, let's say a fifth of 60,000. Why? That's 12,000. So it could support 12,000 pounds. So I don't weigh that much, so that should be safe. But I mean, that's how you do it. Anyway, so half inch is plenty strong enough. Quarter inch would be strong enough to support human weight too. But with the size of angle iron, it's so big and everything, it's so hefty. A human could weigh more than I do. But you got two of these bolts. You got to multiply by two, so it's 0.2, you can multiply by whatever that was, 12,000 pounds by 2 to get the weight that it could support would be 24,000, not 12,000, because you multiply by 2, because you have two bolts holding it. But if all the weight were on one, then you'd have to consider that the maximum could be, you know, 12,000 in that case that it could support on one bolt. You do designing based on that, you know, these kinds of rough calculations, but you wouldn't design something and say, well, you want to over design it for a human, for a human life, you know, you want to preserve human life. You don't design something that's just barely strong enough to support human weight. You want it to be many, many times stronger in case there's a defect in the steel or something. Any, you want it to be far stronger than what is needed. For some reason, I just think half inch is strong enough for human weight, but you know, quarter inch, I don't feel so sure. I don't feel as confident about quarter inch, and I'm not sure why that is. There are torques too. It can bend. The bolt can also be bent by putting a torque on it. And that would weaken it a little bit too, but I don't think, I mean, it seems a quarter inch is plenty strong enough, but it just doesn't feel that way. It just doesn't seem that way. And it would be, right? It would be a quarter as strong as what we just said. So it would be 6,000 pounds if instead of 24,000 for quarter inch. But that's if it really was quarter inch. It might be specified as quarter inch, but it's not really quarter inch. So yeah, it's actually less than quarter inch. So you have to, you know, if you go down to eighth inch, it's going to be again. If it's a half, you square it, it becomes a quarter as strong again. So you go down a quarter of 6,000 is 1,500 pounds is what you're with eighth inch. Now we're getting down to where, you know, a human can't weigh that much, but it's an eighth inch is not really big enough to support human weight. It just doesn't. It is, but it doesn't feel that way. It doesn't seem that way. So, you know, you use something that seems like overkill. You want overkill when you're dealing with human life. You don't want to risk a human life. So you design something that's far stronger than what it needs to be when you're talking about saving human life and limb kind of thing. But we're not hanging off a cliff here. It's not like, it's not that kind of life. It's just hanging in the basement just so it doesn't break, just so a person, me, doesn't fall to the floor from the rafters, which would only be a fall of about 3 feet at the most, you know, it's not, or 2 feet or whatever. It's probably, I'm not going to be more than 6 inches off the floor when I'm doing the chin-ups, because it's not like I'm going to fall and hurt myself. So I don't need to have it, but I've got whatever size bolts I've got, I'll use whatever size. It won't need something massive like 3/4, or I don't want to put big holes in my joists. So that's the other thing. You don't want to put holes in your joists at all, because it weakens the ceiling, the floor of the up of this ground level, or the main level of the house is supported by these ceiling joists in the basement. Those ceiling joists are, you don't want to put holes in them, so we want to use the smallest hole possible as well. So it's a trade-off between, obviously it's overkill for supporting my weight, so it's not really a trade-off, but you don't want to, it's always going to be a trade-off between the strength of the bolt and the size of the hole that's going to weaken the structure you're building. So that's all of this is planning and opportunity to plan. It's an opportunity to rethink everything, to think about design, to think about how do you build something, how do you maximize strength. I don't want to drill bigger holes than I need to. Maybe 3/8 is a good size. 3/8 might be a good size. That's somewhere in between quarter and half. That might be good. So I don't like a half just because, but it's not going to really weaken the, especially if I'm only putting one hole. The other thing is, if the ceiling joist is under compression or whether it's under tension, you want to put the hole on the side which is compression, not the side which is on tension. So if I'm putting the hole near the bottom of it, but it's got, well, it's supported on a beam in the center and a beam on the other side, right? And all the weight of the dead weight of the house and me standing on the upstairs pressing down, any weight of furniture is pushing down here. And that's bending this joist. It's bent in a curve like that, right? And that puts the underside in tension, and it puts the top side here in compression. It's compressed and it's stretched underneath because it's being bent like this. It's under tension underneath, so if I'm putting the hole near there, that's going to weaken it more than if I put the attachment point up near the point where it's under compression near the top. So that's something to think about also, but it's just such a strong, you know, putting a hole in it it's not going to make any difference, right? Because you could even remove, I could even put a notch if I wanted to, but you would never do this. But if I were passing pipe along and I wanted it to be flush, I could put a notch in the joist as long as it's not deeper than a certain amount. So as long as the notch is only of a certain restricted length along the joist, that doesn't weaken it very much. But you'd never put notches in your joists, right? So you might put a hole in the joist is better than a notch, because then it still has structure around the hole. But we're talking about the only holes that are going to cause any serious damage are like kind of like big holes. If you put big holes or notches like that in your joist, that's when you have a serious issue. You don't want to do that. But even when I put a small hole, I think about this. Like, how many times am I going to put holes before this thing gets weak? And what does it mean in terms of strength? How much strength am I losing? I don't do it unless I can justify. And there's probably a way to attach it without putting a hole. It's another thing. There might be, right? There are other ways. So that's what I need to think about when I'm designing this, is what other way can I attach this without... Well, one way would be to use an existing hole, if there is one. There's already a hole, then if there's a hole, I don't need to make a new one. And there's other ways of maybe clamp. A clamp would work too. That wouldn't be as strong or as safe. But there's other possible ways. You could hang from the top of the joist. I could put something that goes around the joist. If there's a gap at the top, I could put a wire around it and then hang it from the wire. You see all the different things you could do. It would have to be strong enough. Whatever is done, it has to be strong enough. And in the end, I might just say, okay, drill a hole. But I have to think about all these things before I drill the hole, so that I'm exercising my design skills and so that I'm learning more about everything, about the universe, right? About life, about the laws of physics, and about the laws of nature, really, is what it is. The creation is what it really is, that Jehovah created. Let's read Psalm 19. Wow, we've really talked a long time here. That's probably what happens when I wake up. Oh, my arrowroot powder came. I told you that. That's right. I almost forgot that. I mentioned that. That just arrived. Thanks to the delivery people again, and Amazon and everybody. Now I've got most of the main ingredients, so I'm waiting for... No, I don't have the clay yet. That's the most important, maybe. So I'm still waiting for the clay, I think. Is that true? Yeah, I got the aloe vera, and I got the arrowroot now. I'm waiting for the clay. And that is supposed to be coming. That was shipped very soon, but it wasn't going to arrive right away. It shipped very quickly. Where's the shipping on this? Let's see. It's this one. Okay, here it is. Thank goodness it didn't pop up on the screen I'm looking at, although it wouldn't matter, but it shipped. It's not supposed to arrive. Oh, it's supposed to arrive. Oh, no. It's coming from a long ways away, apparently. It's coming from maybe from China. It's not coming soon. It's one that's not going to arrive right away. It's got a month expectation on the 21 days at least for the expectation arrival time. I didn't realize that when I ordered it. They didn't say that at the time when I ordered it. I don't believe that was... They weren't telling me that. But it was shipped very early on, so... Track package. I don't know. It was shipped on the 13th. But it's not supposed to arrive till November 2nd or 23rd. That's shocking that that's a long time. Because that's my main ingredient. If that doesn't arrive, then... the problem with that is I would never plan it. I would never have ordered it if I knew that was going to happen, because I want to order something I can get immediately, so that my main ingredient, I'm not wondering when is it going to be here. But I've got another thing on order, which is still not arrived. It's a piece of copper wire that I ordered a long time ago, and it's supposed to get here by the 26th of October. It's been weeks I've been waiting for that. So it's a slow boat from China. That's what happens. They get on a slow boat from China because they can save money shipping that way. The people in China who are shipping it are, whatever the reason is, they're reasoning it out somehow that is a more economical way to do it, so they're doing it that way. Whatever the reason. So let's turn to our study for the day, little children, to the Director of Melody of David, Psalm 19. Jehovah, guide us in our study today, in Jesus' name. The heavens are declaring the glory of God. We know this psalm. The heavens are declaring the glory of God, and of the work of his hands the expanse is telling. One day after another day causes speech to bubble forth, and one night after another night shows forth knowledge. There is no speech, and there are no words. No voice on their part is being heard. Into all the earth their measuring line has gone out, and to the extremity of the productive land their utterances. In them he has set a tent for the sun, and it is like a bridegroom when coming out of his nuptial chamber. It exults as a mighty man does to run in a path. From one extremity of the heavens is its going forth, and its finished circuit is to their other extremities. And there is nothing concealed from its heat. The law of Jehovah is perfect, bringing back the soul. The reminder of Jehovah is trustworthy, making the inexperienced one wise. The orders from Jehovah are upright, causing the heart to rejoice. The commandment of Jehovah is clean, making the eyes shine. The fear of Jehovah is pure, standing forever. The judicial decisions of Jehovah are true. They have proved altogether righteous. They are more to be desired than gold. Yes, than much refined gold, and sweeter than honey, and the flowing honey of the combs. Also, your own servant has been warned by them. In the keeping of them there is a large reward. Mistakes, who can discern? From concealed sins pronounce me innocent. Also, from presumptuous acts hold your servant back. Do not let them dominate me. In that case I shall be complete, and I shall have remained innocent from much transgression. Let the sayings of my mouth and the meditation of my heart become pleasurable before you, O Jehovah, my rock and my redeemer. Psalms 19. All about Jehovah. The sayings of my mouth and the meditation of my heart become pleasurable before you, O Jehovah, my rock and my redeemer. Jehovah is our rock and our redeemer. He's like a shield, as we have read. He's a strength to us. He's a source of strength. What do we read in 18? My shield and my horn of salvation, 18:2. My secure height. He's a very multifaceted person, Jehovah is. The heavens are declaring his glory, Psalm 19. He talks about, that's again David writing this song about Jehovah's glory, and he talks about the wonders of the planet on which we live when he mentions the sun and how it crosses the sky and it heats everything so effectively. And the idea is also present in Psalm 19 about Jehovah's justice, his law and the idea that Jehovah is concerned with justice, and he does want us to be given justice, is the very clear idea there. It's really something to read that. So now, Song of Solomon, chapter 7. How beautiful your steps have become in your sandals, O willing daughter. The curvings of your thighs are like ornaments, the work of an artisan's hands. Your navel roll is a round bowl. Let not the mixed wine be lacking from it. Let not the mixed wine be lacking from it. Your belly is a heap of wheat, fenced about with lilies. Your two breasts are like young ones, or like two young ones, the twins of a female gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are like the pools in Heshbon, by the gate of Bath-Rabbim. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon, which is looking out toward Damascus. Your head upon you is like Carmel, and the tresses of your head are like wool dyed reddish purple. The king is held bound by the flowings. How beautiful you are, and how pleasant you are, O beloved girl, among exquisite delights. This stature of yours does resemble a palm tree, and your breasts date clusters. I have said I shall go up on the palm tree, that I may take hold of its fruit stalks of dates. And, please, may your breasts become like clusters of the vine, and the fragrance of your nose like apples, and your palate like the best wine that is going with the slickness for my dear one, softly flowing over the lips of sleeping ones. I am my dear one's, and toward me is his craving. Do come, O my dear one, and let us go forth to the field. Do let us lodge among the henna plants. Do let us rise early and go to the vineyards, that we may see whether the vine has sprouted, the blossom has burst open, the pomegranate trees have bloomed. There I shall give my expressions of endearment to you. The mandrakes themselves have given their fragrance, and by our entrance ways there are all sorts of the choicest fruits, the new ones as well as the old. Oh, my dear one, I have treasured up for you. That's the end of that chapter of Song of Solomon. And that was the shepherd writing in the first section, and then the Shulamite maiden in the last part, where she says, I am my dear one's, and toward me is his craving. Just before that, we saw an interesting an interesting wording in verse 9. Your palate like the best wine that is going with the slickness for my dear one. The wine is an illustration. It's not literal wine. It's talking like, it's like the best wine. It's not actually talking about literal wine, but figurative wine in the metaphor. But it's Solomon talking to the maiden. It's saying, may your breasts become like the clusters of the vine, and the fragrance of your nose like apples, and your palate like the best wine. But then he says that is going with a slickness for my dear one. And who is his dear one? It's her. But the thing is, she refers to him as her dear one. It's an interesting thing. It's the only time where he refers to her as his dear one so far. Softly flowing over the lips of sleeping ones. It's very interesting. It's so vivid, this poetry. It's a song, of course. It's so vivid in its descriptiveness, and its imagination. It's imagine imaginativeness. Why don't we speak more often so that we can learn how to pronounce all the words? But over the lips of sleeping ones. I mean, how can it flow over the lips of sleeping ones? That's something that's unique to the Hebrew language. Hebrew is not a language, I don't think. This is unique to the Hebrew language. It's remarkable because from the Hebrew we get the metaphors like on the face of the earth. That's a Hebrew metaphor. The face of the earth. We don't consider the earth has a face normally in any other language, but in Hebrew it does. So, I mean, as far as we know, that comes from Hebrew. That's the thing. It came from the Hebrew. And just like over the lips of sleeping ones, what does it mean? Like, how can wine flow over the lips of sleeping ones? It's the most puzzling kind of metaphor or illustration of some kind. Softly flowing over the lips of sleeping ones, but it's the most poetically beautiful poetry because of its mystery as well, that we don't really understand what it's talking about. I mean, if they're sleeping, how would they know what her palate was like? I mean, you know, how would their lips be in contact with her palate? It's a very beautiful but curious and imaginative expression. It's wonderful in some way that is not really comparable to anything else, or it's not explicable. That's the thing about the Bible too. It's not just this one section of the Bible that's like that either. It's like music. It touches us deeply many times, and it remains with us once we've read it. So I think we're on Ephesians 5. Is that right? We just did 7? So we're 19, 7 and 5. Ephesians 5. Let's check 4 again just to make sure. I, the prisoner in the Lord. Yeah. Lowliness of mind. Yeah, we read that. 5. Ephesians 5. Therefore, become imitators of God as beloved children, and go on walking in love, just as the Christ also loved you, and delivered himself up for you as an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling odor. Let fornication and uncleanness of every sort or greediness not even be mentioned among you, just as it befits holy people, neither shameful conduct, nor foolish talking, nor obscene jesting, things which are not becoming, but rather the giving of thanks. For you know this, recognizing it for yourselves, that no fornicator or unclean person or greedy person, which means being an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of the Christ and of God. Let no man deceive you with empty words. For because of the aforesaid things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not become partakers with them. For you were once darkness, but you are now light in connection with the Lord. Go on walking as children of light. For the fruitage of the light consists of every sort of goodness and righteousness and truth. Keep on making sure of what is acceptable to the Lord, and quit sharing with them in the unfruitful works that belong to the darkness, but rather even be reproving them. For the things that take place in secret by them, it is shameful even to relate. Now all the things that are being reproved are made manifest by the light, for everything that is being made manifest is light. Wherefore he says, "Awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and the Christ will shine upon you." So, keep strict watch that how you walk is not as unwise, but as wise persons, buying out the opportune time for yourselves, because the days are wicked. On this account, cease becoming unreasonable, but go on perceiving what the will of Jehovah is. Also, do not be getting drunk with wine, in which there is debauchery, but keep getting filled with spirit, speaking to yourselves with psalms and praises to God and spiritual songs, singing and accompanying yourselves with music in your hearts to Jehovah, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, giving thanks always for all things to our God and Father. Be in subjection to one another in fear of Christ. Let wives be in subjection to their husbands as to the Lord, because a husband is head of his wife, as the Christ also is head of the congregation, he being a savior of this body. In fact, as the congregation is in subjection to the Christ, so let wives also be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, continue loving your wives just as the Christ also loved the congregation and delivered up himself for it, that he might sanctify it, cleansing it with the bath of water by means of the word, that he might present the congregation to himself in its splendor, not having a spot or a wrinkle or any of such things, but that it should be holy and without blemish. In this way, husbands ought to be loving their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no man ever hated his own flesh, but he feeds and cherishes it, as the Christ also does the congregation, because we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and his mother, and he will stick to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This sacred secret is great. Now I am speaking with respect to Christ and the congregation. Nevertheless, also let each one of you individually so love his wife as he does himself. On the other hand, the wife should have deep respect for her husband. So that's Ephesians 5, and it's including this idea that's so important about husbands loving their wives, actively loving their wives, and wives having, on the other hand, a different attitude somewhat from that of their husbands toward them, which is that the wives should have deep respect for their husbands. That's indicating that this is what men really desire from their wives, is, of course, they want love from their wives. One would also suppose that to be true, but it's mainly the thing is that without respect, if their wives don't respect their husbands, then the husband can't really feel that he's doing his own, performing his own role, that he can't really feel like he's, you know, he's in a position to do his job as the husband. But his job is not primarily either to give respect to his wife. The thing is, the idea is that the husband is given the responsibility of being first in command, and that is why the wife is expected by the husband. He expects her to give him respect because he needs that. He needs that in order for him to function, in order for his functions to be carried out as the head of the family. But on the other hand, he's not to put his wife, you know, above himself by giving her that much respect. So there's of course the husband respects his wife. He just doesn't respect her with the same level of respect that is necessary from her toward him in order for him to function as the head. There's a level of respect that the wife has for the husband, and the husband, on the other hand, loves his wife with a greater love than what would be expected from the wife toward the husband. There's still going to be love both ways. It's going to be respect both ways. It's quite a very what's the word? Little known. It's a little known thing that this is the secret toward, about the secret regarding having a successful, about, yeah, the secret about having a successful marriage is the way that each of the husband and wife treat each other. That a woman needs love. She needs a lot of love. And we see this, we can see a good example in the Song of Solomon, where the song, I mean, this, the shepherd in the song, Solomon, is he loves his wife so intensely because he finds her so beautiful, and he's sharing his expressions about how beautiful she is continually, how beautiful she is, over and over, because he loves her so much, and he sees nothing but beauty in her. And that's a lot to do with what love is about, is being able to see what's good about people and what's beautiful about people. It's a lot to do with why we love them. We see such good things in them. But this love is what is going from the male toward the female, and then the female is giving back what the male needs, which is respect. That she is somewhat, well, she sees him as in the, let's just use the Song of Solomon as the example. She sees him as her dear one. So she respects him as her dear one, that she sees, she has a great deal of respect for her, and she cherishes, I mean, she has a great deal of respect for him, and she cherishes him as her dear one. That's the kind of respect, that's love in a sense. Love is everything, because love encompasses everything, including respect. So it's a form of love to show respect for somebody, is a form of love too. Just like, you know, erotic love is a form of love. All these different forms of love, all the principles of love are still part of love too. And that means everything is love. Jehovah is love, and he's the personification of love. And so really it's all really love anyway, but we talk about other concepts because they're just different from each other, but they're all part of love. And the Christ loved us, and he offered himself up for a sacrifice, and, you know, to God. But the husband offers himself up as a sacrifice too. That we'll get to that, I think, later in Ephesians, but we'll see that. But the husband is giving love to his wife, and that's the giving of love is, in a sense, a sacrifice too. You don't have to admit that someone else is beautiful. You could just keep that to yourself, or just ignore that, or just carry on with thinking you are beautiful yourself, or you are seeing the. You could just continue to look for the beauty in yourself and not look for the beauty in others. So loving somebody by seeing the beauty in them is a sacrifice too. But the husbands should be loving their wives as their own bodies, it says in verse 28. And also, a man leaves his father and mother. That's important. He doesn't just try to carry on doing everything in his ancestral family. He leaves his father and mother. He becomes a new family with his wife. That they become one flesh. That's a very significant concept that's not fully understood or appreciated by many people. So that was our study. I think we better wrap it up. I think we're at our maximal kind of length. So before I start talking about something else, I'm disappointed about the fact that I may not have the clay for a while to make the foot powder, but that's okay, I guess. It just means I have to make do with make the foot powder that I have last longer. Oh yeah, I wanted to say something about the foot powder. That's true. I'm using the foot powder, and I don't have to put it on my feet every day. You know, because I'm not having to wash my feet every day. They're staying clean. Everything's fine. So this is what I've learned about the foot powder. It's very, very, and it's natural, organic. but it's very, very conducive to keeping clean feet, and I don't have to use it every day. So the foot powder that I've got will probably continue to last me for several months or something. You know, it's still, because I don't have to put it on every day, even though I've only got a small amount in the bottle, plastic bottle of foot powder. It was something like 100 grams, I think I had, of it. Originally, I've got maybe 30 grams left. But it you only have to put a small amount, and you rub it between your toes, and it keeps the skin dry. That's the thing. And it's not... I'll find out as time goes on how good it is for the skin, whether it's good for the skin or not. I'll find out. But I've got skin cream I can put on, too. You know, which is a different thing. I don't know how that skin cream would interact with this foot powder, because I've never put them on at the same time or any time close to the same time. There are many things to explore, but this, with regard to the feet, I think now that I've got this foot powder, but it will mean a lot of potential benefits with having clean feet, I think. We'll see, though, how well it goes with the skin on the feet. In between the toes, it's wonderful not to have any moisture between the toes, because it keeps it dry, and I don't have to put the powder. I don't even have to put the powder on every day. I will rub it between the toes every day if it's not completely dry in there, but it doesn't need it. So this is Ward Green. It's October 19th, 2022, 16, 18 hours, right on the button when I said it. It was 16, 18 hours. And I hope you have a wonderful day. I hope you're coping with all your problems, whatever they might be. And I hope you have a wonderful victory over whatever problems and enemies you might have. And by being faithful to Jehovah, I hope things turn out well for you in every possible way. And thank you for watching and listening. And I love you. Bye for now.